Imagine trying to run a massive, highly profitable multinational corporation, but your board of directors is chosen entirely by a genetic lottery.
Right, and your CEO is basically a political puppet for a hostile foreign government.
Exactly. That was literally the state of the Jewish high priesthood just before the time of Jesus. I mean, it sounds like a recipe for absolute systemic collapse. And yet, somehow, the culture survived.
Yeah, the way they manage that survival is it's one of the most fascinating organizational pivots in human history.
Which is exactly why you and I are here. Welcome to a brand new deep dive. I'm your host, and I'm joined, as always, by our resident expert.
Great to be here. We are looking at a community that was forced to adapt to survive, massive political upheaval, shifting empires, and just intense cultural disruption.
So our mission today is taking Dr. Anthony Tomasino's historical notes on Judaism before Jesus and really extracting the fundamental mechanics of how the society completely restructured itself.
We're basically looking at three massive pillars today: the temple, the synagogue, and the Sanhedrin.
Right. And for you listening right now, this is essentially a masterclass in how any organization, whether it's a business or a community, balances the sheer power of centralized control against the resilience of local adaptability.
Because we are tracking a journey from temporary nomadic tents to these impregnable stone fortresses, and then out of sheer necessity to a totally decentralized open source community network.
So to understand how a community successfully decentralizes, I mean, you first have to understand the massive centralized monopoly it built in the first place, right?
Exactly. You really have to understand the temple. And the irony here is that the temple didn't start as a permanent structure at all.
Not even close.
No, the origins of this entire religious system were entirely mobile. The original structure was the tabernacle, which was fundamentally just a highly specialized tent.
Designed specifically to roll up and carry the Ark of the Covenant, right? The literal physical symbol of God's presence.
Yep, wherever the nomadic Israelites went, the tent went. It was a completely portable center of gravity.
But, nomadic societies eventually settle down. King David establishes a kingdom, he consolidates his military power, and he builds himself this magnificent palace in Jerusalem.
And the texts tell us he essentially looks out the window, sees the tent, and feels a deep sense of guilt.
Yeah, he complains to the prophet Nathan. He points out the absurdity that he's living in a fortified palace of cedar while the symbol of his God is still just, sitting out in a tent.
What's fascinating here is that David's impulse is a very common human desire. When a society gains wealth and stability, it wants to build something permanent to reflect that power.
Right, to monumentalize the belief.
Exactly. But according to the narrative, God tells David that he has shed way too much blood to build this monument, so the task falls to his son, Solomon.
Which brings us to Solomon's Temple, constructed around 921 BC. And okay, let's unpack this for a second.
Oh, the Phoenician connection.
Yes, because there is a detail in the sources regarding Solomon's Temple that is just a brilliant historical irony. This structure is intended to be the ultimate exclusive symbol of the Jewish faith.
But it was designed and built by Phoenician craftsmen.
Using a distinctly Phoenician architectural style, I mean, that is the equivalent of the United States deciding to build the ultimate monument to American democracy, but outsourcing the blueprints, the materials, and the labor entirely to a rival superpower.
It really is. And the archaeological record backs that up completely. The floor plan of Solomon's temple matches other temples found throughout the ancient Near East.
So the architecture was borrowed.
Right. But the function it eventually served was entirely unique. Once that permanent structure existed in Jerusalem, it initiated this slow, centuries-long crawl toward absolute centralization.
And the real tipping point there arrives with King Josiah, because Josiah executes what is essentially a ruthless corporate merger.
That is a highly accurate way to look at it, actually. The Book of Deuteronomy contained a command that God would establish his name in one specific place.
And Josiah takes that mandate and weaponizes it.
Totally. He sends his forces out into the countryside and literally demolishes all the local shrines, the high places where rural people had been worshiping and sacrificing for generations,
He just wipes them out.
overnight. He decrees that from that moment on, all animal sacrifice must happen exclusively in Jerusalem under the direct supervision of the high priest.
Think about the logistical and economic shockwave of that decision for a second. Josiah eliminates all the mom-and-pop rural shrines. Local priests who had steady jobs and social standing are suddenly unemployed.
and everyone in the region is now forced to travel to one specific city to fulfill their basic religious obligations.
Right. I mean, on one hand, Josiah solves the quality control issue. The authorities no longer have to worry about what unorthodox rituals people might be conducting out in the hillsides.
But structurally, he creates a massive, highly vulnerable single point of failure.
Yeah, and we see how strict that monopoly was even among the diaspora. Our sources note that during the intertestamental period, that roughly 400-year gap between the Old and New Testaments, there were actually a couple of other Jewish temples built outside of Judea.
Right. There was one down in Egypt at a place called Elephantine and another in the Transjordan.
Wait, I assumed Josiah's mandate meant zero temples anywhere else, ever. How did they get away with building rival temples?
Well, by being intensely deferential, the architecture of these secondary locations physically acknowledged Jerusalem's supremacy.
Oh, like the way they were built.
Exactly. Their doors were literally constructed to face toward Jerusalem. And the crucial caveat here, animal sacrifice was strictly banned at these locations.
Ah, so they could burn incense, they could offer grain, but the monopoly on blood sacrifice remained entirely locked within the walls of Jerusalem.
100%. And that geographic monopoly only becomes more extreme over time. If we fast forward past the Babylonian destruction of Solomon's temple, we get to the Second Temple period.
Specifically, the era of Herod the Great. And Herod wants to outdo the Roman Emperor Augustus, who is currently building massive monuments all over Rome.
So Herod decides to turn the Second Temple in Jerusalem into one of the great engineering wonders of the ancient world. But he faces a massive logistical nightmare.
Because the mandate is that the daily sacrifices cannot stop.
Right. Not for construction. Not for a single day.
So how do you completely demolish and rebuild a colossal stone temple without interrupting the daily slaughter happening inside it? You use a Russian nesting ball strategy.
It's brilliant engineering.
It really is. Herod's engineers leveled the top of the Temple Mount with crushed stone just to create a massive enough foundation. Then they built the massive new temple walls completely around the old functioning temple.
And only when the new impenetrable outer shell and roof were entirely secured did they allow the priests to go inside, secretly dismantle the old shrine piece by piece, and pass the rubble out through the doors.
Unbelievable. But the sheer scale of what Herod built transformed the temple's function in society, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It was no longer just a religious site housing the presence of God and facilitating the annual Yom Kippur ritual. It became a heavily fortified complex.
With astonishingly thick walls.
Right. It functioned as a literal military fortress where defenders could take refuge, bar the massive gates, and wait out Roman sieges.
It also became the most secure bank in the entire region. Wealthy individuals from all over the Mediterranean would deposit their fortunes there.
Because in the ancient world, storing your gold in a temple was the equivalent of a modern Swiss bank account. Stealing from a deity was considered the ultimate taboo.
This raises a huge question about the aftermath of its eventual destruction by the Romans in 70 AD. It wasn't just a localized religious tragedy.
No, the National Bank, the Supreme Court, the military stronghold, and the exclusive center of religious ritual all vanished in a single fire.
And the void that left was so profound that we actually still see echoes of it today. The source notes a modern controversy in Chicago where some ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities were performing sacrifices of chickens.
Which led to a massive uproar with local animal rights groups.
Yeah, but from a historical perspective, that modern friction highlights the massive, unresolved theological void left when you build an entire religious framework around a sacrificial monopoly, and then that monopoly is permanently destroyed.
Which naturally leads to the next question. You have this impenetrable fortress that controls all the money, all the sacrifices, and all the political leverage. Who actually runs this monopoly?
Who gets the keys to the vault? We have to look at the massive logistical machine of the priesthood.
And the defining characteristic of this machine is that it was entirely restricted by genetics. You could not apply for the priesthood. You could not study your way into it.
You had to prove you were a direct descendant of Aaron, the brother of Moses. Which sounds like a standard ancient mythological claim until you look at the modern science.
The DNA study on the Kohanim.
Yes. Our sources highlight this large-scale genealogical DNA study conducted on modern Jews who claim this priestly lineage. Because the priesthood passes exclusively from father to son, geneticists can track specific markers on the Y chromosome.
And the data actually backs up the ancient texts.
It does. There's a remarkably high probability that the vast majority of these men trace their lineage back to a single male ancestor from the distant past. It is a stunning validation of their record keeping.
But from an organizational standpoint, a genetic monopoly creates a massive logistical crisis. As the generations multiply over hundreds of years, you suddenly have thousands of priests.
The temple simply cannot employ or feed all of them at once, so they had to institute a complex shift work system.
The texts indicate the priesthood was divided into 12 major courses or divisions. You didn't live at the temple full time.
Right. Your division would travel to Jerusalem to serve your scheduled shift, and then you'd go back to your rural hometown and work a normal side job like farming or trading until your rotation came up again.
And even when your division was on duty in Jerusalem, getting to actually perform the prestigious daily sacrifices was entirely left to chance. They used a lottery system.
Which is exactly the mechanism we see in the New Testament with Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist. He finally wins the lottery to burn incense in the sanctuary.
But winning that lottery wasn't merely a spiritual honor. It was a literal meal ticket.
Yeah, the officiating priest got to keep a designated portion of the sacrificial meat. And in an ancient economy where meat was a huge luxury, that was a highly lucrative perk.
But wherever you have a rigid monopoly controlling a finite, valuable resource, severe corruption inevitably follows. By the time of the Great Revolt against Rome in 70 AD, the priestly system was catastrophically broken.
The elite, aristocratic priests at the top of the hierarchy were hoarding the resources.
And deploying thugs to physically beat the lower-level priests and steal their rightful portions of the sacrifices. The sources record that some of these lower-level priests literally starved to death because of the greed of their own leadership.
Wow. And the man sitting at the very top of this corrupt pyramid was the high priest. The theological definition of his role is really fascinating because we usually think of ancient leaders like pharaohs as representing the gods down to the people.
But the high priest's job was the exact inverse. He represented the flawed people up to a perfect God. He was the ultimate mediator.
Theologically, yes, but practically, he was the most powerful political figure in Judea. Because there was no longer a Davidic king on the throne during this period, the foreign overlords often utilized the high priest as their local governor.
Right, the Greeks, the Ptolemies, or later the Romans. He became the man responsible for extracting taxes from the Jewish population and paying massive tributes to the empires.
Think about how devastating that is for his public image. You are supposed to be the holy mediator advocating for your people's salvation, but on Tuesday, you are the guy sending armed guards to shake down those same people for Roman taxes.
It completely eroded the moral authority of the priesthood. The sources point out that back in the Old Testament book of Malachi, when a terrible famine hits the land, the prophet directly blames the priests.
He doesn't blame the weather?
Nope. He says the famine is happening because the priests have entirely failed in their duty as teachers of the law. And nature abhors a vacuum.
So because the priests abandoned their intellectual responsibilities in favor of political power, another group stepped in.
Exactly. By 200 BC, as we see documented in texts like the Book of Ben Sira, the intellectual and teaching authority had shifted almost entirely to the scribes.
And scribes were originally just copyists, right?
Yeah, but because they spent all day reading and transcribing the law, they became the ultimate experts on it. The high priest was left wearing incredibly expensive robes and performing bloody rituals, but the actual intellectual leadership had been outsourced.
Wait, if the scribes have captured all the intellectual authority, and the foreign empires are the ones actually pulling the political strings, weren't the high priests essentially just highly dressed ancient politicians clinging to a meat distribution monopoly?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the historical record backs that up completely. The high priesthood became an incredibly unstable, elite institution. Their actual power surged and crashed depending entirely on who was currently conquering Judea.
I know the sources mentioned the Hasmoneans as an exception, but that was a deeply controversial era, right?
Oh, absolutely. The Hasmoneans were the Jewish rebel commanders who successfully drove the Greeks out of Jerusalem. They were war heroes. And as a reward to themselves, these military generals simply took over the high priesthood.
Even though they weren't from the correct priestly lineage.
Right, it was a massive scandal. It's like a four-star general staging a military coup and then abruptly naming himself the Pope. It briefly boosted the political prestige of the office, but it alienated the religious purists.
And eventually King Herod, who was intensely paranoid about any rival power, completely gutted the remaining civil authority of the high priest anyway.
Turning the office into a total puppet regime.
So put yourself in the shoes of an everyday Jewish person living out in the diaspora. You live in Alexandria, Egypt, or out in Greece. You are hundreds of miles away from Jerusalem.
The temple is controlled by corrupt aristocrats.
Right. The high priest is a Roman puppet, and you literally cannot perform the central ritual of your faith because Josiah's ancient mandate says sacrifices can only happen in that one specific city. You are totally alienated. How do you maintain your cultural identity?
Well, you have to invent something entirely new. You have to decouple your identity from the physical fortress. And that geographical distance birthed one of the most radical, resilient innovations in religious history.
The synagogue. And here's where we really need to address a very persistent historical myth. If you ask most people when the synagogue was invented, they will tell you it started during the Babylonian exile.
Because the first temple was destroyed, and the Israelites were dragged off to Babylon. It sounds logical. They didn't have a temple, so they must have invented the synagogue to survive.
Right. It makes perfect logical sense. But as Dr. Tomasino points out in the notes, there is absolutely zero historical or archaeological evidence to support that theory. We actually have no idea what mechanisms they used to preserve their faith in Babylon.
The reality of the synagogue's origin is much more complex, and it was heavily influenced by the surrounding culture.
The earliest concrete archaeological evidence we actually have for a synagogue is a physical plaque discovered in Egypt dating to around 200 BC.
Dedicating a building as a house of prayer.
Exactly. And the heavy influence here isn't Babylonian, it's Greek. Even the word we use, synagogue, is entirely Greek. It translates roughly to led together or sitting together.
What's fascinating here is the complete structural inversion from the temple model. The temple was an exclusive, heavily centralized, closed-door VIP club. It was rigidly hierarchical, and your role was determined strictly by your genetics.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The synagogue operates like an ancient, open-source startup. It was a completely decentralized, peer-to-peer network.
The structure was radically democratic, which really reflects the Greek civic environment where it developed. The leaders of the synagogue weren't born into the role. They were elected by the local community.
And perhaps the most shocking detail to a modern listener is that during this early period, there were no officiating ministers.
There were no paid, stationary rabbis leading a weekly service.
Wait, if they didn't have a local rabbi or a priest, how did a service actually function?
Well, the title rabbi at this point simply referred to an itinerant traveling teacher. Inside the local synagogue, any adult male could step up to the front, unroll the scrolls, read the text, and offer a teaching.
It was entirely based on communal participation, not genetic privilege. And from what the sources describe, the vibe of these gatherings was not the hushed, deeply reverent atmosphere we'd associate with modern religious services.
Not at all. It functioned much more like a Greek philosopher's academy. Someone would read a text, and then the room would debate it. They argued. They actively fought over the interpretations of the law.
It was active, participatory learning. And architecturally, these buildings were highly practical. They featured a specific niche carved out to safely store the expensive scrolls.
They built balconies for observers, which often included women or interested Gentiles who were known historically as God-fearers.
And crucially, they had collection boxes positioned at the doors. The synagogue functioned as a local crowdfunding mechanism, collecting charity and distributing it directly to the poor within their own town.
But the absolute non-negotiable rule of this new open-source network: no sacrifices. Zero.
Because Josiah's monopoly still held psychological sway.
Right. They replaced the blood of animal sacrifices with the intense intellectual debate of ancient texts. If a descendant of Aaron happened to be in the room, the community might defer to him to give a final blessing out of traditional respect. But his ritual monopoly had absolutely no power in that space.
And that specific innovation merging Jewish textual devotion with the Greek model of democratic civic assembly is exactly what saved the culture.
Without a massive stone building or ancient relics to anchor them, they built an indestructible, portable identity based entirely on localized learning and communal support.
But solving the religious problem creates a new practical problem. The synagogue brilliantly handled local worship and charity. But what happens when two Jewish merchants in a diaspora town in Greece have a severe contract dispute?
Or a disagreement over property lines.
Right. You can't travel for 3 weeks to Jerusalem to stand before the high priest over a local property lawsuit. You need a system of local governance.
Exactly. You need an institution that can handle civil and legal disputes without relying on the corrupt, centralized power in Judea. Enter the Sanhedrin.
Now, you might assume, given the Greek name Sanhedrin, meaning a council sitting together, that this was another entirely Greek invention like the synagogue.
It's a natural assumption. But the historical mechanics are actually different here. While the synagogue was a genuinely new innovation, heavily shaped by Greek culture, the Sanhedrin was a rebranding of a deeply ancient, homegrown Middle Eastern practice.
Oh, the local councils of elders.
Right. For centuries, towns in the region were governed by local elders. They just adopted a trendy Greek name for an ancient tradition to legitimize it in a changing world.
Structurally, how did they operate?
It depended on the size of the population. Smaller cities and towns would establish a local Sanhedrin consisting of 23 adult men. Then, in Jerusalem, you had the massive Great Sanhedrin, a council of 71 elites that handled the major national disputes, both civil and religious.
But in these local diaspora towns, how did 23 older men actually enforce their rulings? It's not like they had a dedicated police force to throw you in jail if you ignored their verdict on a property dispute.
They didn't need a police force because they had a much more powerful weapon social cohesion. The Sanhedrin was essentially a voluntary association of the town's most respected men. If you defied a ruling by the local Sanhedrin, you were socially and economically ostracized by the entire community.
And in the ancient world, being cut off from your community's trade networks and social support was essentially a death sentence. That intense social pressure was their enforcement mechanism.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? We look at the Sanhedrin, an ancient homegrown concept that adopted a Greek name. We look at the synagogue, a fundamentally Greek concept of democratic assembly that became the ultimate defining staple of Jewish life.
It forces you to realize that so much of what we consider to be ancient, rigid tradition is actually the result of brilliant, localized adaptation.
The ultimate genius of both the synagogue and the Sanhedrin was their modularity. They gave scattered communities a standardized mechanism for self-policing, education, and social welfare.
They proved that local authority could effectively mirror the centralized power in Jerusalem without needing to literally be in Jerusalem. They adapted their entire societal structure to survive in a hostile world.
Which really brings this massive organizational journey full circle. We started with a portable nomadic tent. We moved to a magnificent Phoenician-built temple.
We watched it evolve into a massive, stone-crushing fortress and national bank.
Controlled by corrupt political maneuvering and a genetic lottery. But the crucial takeaway for you listening is that as that central hub became corrupted, bloated, and was eventually burned to the ground by the Romans, the culture didn't die with it.
It survived because they had already done the hard work of inventing the decentralized democratic synagogue, and they had formalized the local Sanhedrin to handle everyday life.
And that leaves us with a provocative thought to consider in our own lives today. Throughout history, an over-reliance on a single temple, whether that is a massive central corporate headquarters, a single digital platform that you've built your entire business on, or even an over-reliance on a single charismatic leader, creates a catastrophic vulnerability.
Fortresses, no matter how thick their walls or how massive their foundations, eventually fall. The Romans eventually breach the gates.
The question is, if your personal or professional temple were to be suddenly dismantled or made obsolete tomorrow, have you built a decentralized synagogue network around you?
Have you developed a community, a skill set, and an identity that is adaptable and resilient enough to survive without the fortress?
It is entirely about building the network before the fortress falls. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the roots of ancient community structures. Keep questioning the structures around you, and we will catch you on the next one.